Bruchim Habayim, welcome everybody. This evening, as a treat for those who have come so graciously to the first of the lecture series here in the Miami area, we're going to reveal the most potent tool that anybody can have for dealing with their teenage children. The idea itself, the concept itself, is something that we all know about and heard of. However, the truth is that when we analyze what it really means, very few people actually have a handle on how to use it. The difference between a good kid and a bad kid is one thing. It's not that a good kid is brighter. It's not that a good kid has a more pleasant disposition. The difference between a good kid and a bad kid is that a good kid has somebody who believes in him. End of story. Acceptance is the most potent tool, the most potent, powerful technique that a parent can have when dealing with their children. Now, most people know this. We have to accept our children for what they are. The truth is that although we understand that acceptance is so important, we really don't know what it is. If you tell a kid, "I accept you for what you are," or even your friend, that's the worst thing in the world that you can tell them. Think about it. You come home and your teenage son is blaring the music. The house is vibrating at the sound of every beat. The walls are shaking. You come up and you think that the record player, the stereo, is playing right there in the living room. And you look around and it's not there. And the house is shaking and shaking, and you hear reverberations coming from upstairs. And as you go upstairs further and further, and you have to hold your ears, you finally open that door. You get the courage to do it, and you see that he's having a party over there. The room is a wreck. His friends are all over the place. And it is precisely what you've told him 1,000 times not to do. And you tell him, "Son of mine, don't worry. We accept you for what you are." Now, what does that mean to him? Well, put yourself in his place. Let's take the ladies here for a moment, okay? Your husband comes home, and he finds the supper burnt. And he finds you totally disheveled. He finds the house a wreck. And he goes to you and he says, "Wife of mine, don't worry, I accept you for what you are." So what does that mean? That means that you're incompetent, but he's such a tzaddik, he's such a righteous man, a wonderful man, that he's willing to accept you as you are. What you are isn't all that great. As you are isn't all that much, but he's willing to accept you. When I say that I accept you, I'm not saying anything about you. I'm saying something about me. I say I accept you no matter what. I said nothing about you. My opinion of you could be very low. My perception of what you are could be very, very, very bad. Yet, I accept you because of something in me, not because of something in you. It's a tremendous backfire when parents do this. We've learned this through experience in dealing with teenagers. Acceptance does not mean to tell a kid that no matter what you do or no matter what you are, we accept you. Acceptance means to say something about the kid as opposed to something about you. And in this past week's Parsha, Moshe Rabbeinu did it. There was somebody, he wasn't a kid, as a matter of fact, he was Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law, who decided that he wants to leave the fold, he doesn't want to come into Eretz Yisrael with the rest of the Jews, he wants to return to Midian to his family. And it's now up to Moshe Rabbeinu to convince him to remain with the rest of Klal Yisrael and enter Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe Rabbeinu tells him, Yoimer, Moshe Rabbeinu says, Parshas Bahaloscha Perek Yud Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Al no tazoi voisonu, please don't abandon us. Ki al kein yodata chanoisenu bamidbar v'hoyisa lanu leinayim. V'hoyisa lanu leinayim, you will be our eyes, says Rashi. V'hoyisa lanu leinayim, you will be our eyes. Kol dovor v'dovor, she yis'ale me'einenu, tihiyeh ma'or einenu. anything that we don't know, any Torah that we may not understand, you, Yisroi, will teach us. You will be the light of our eyes. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu told Yisroi. Now, all of the Mefarshim raise an eyebrow when they see this, because Yisroi may have been a big Talmud Chacham, but the Jews going into Eretz Yisrael did not need him to be the light of their eyes. Yehoshua, who the Gemara says was equal in knowledge with Moshe Rabbeinu, was there. Asniel ben Kenaz was there. Yisroi just wasn't in that league. And Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't a liar. What is he saying over here? You know what? I don't understand why the Mefarshim don't understand what this pasuk means. You know, our Sfarim tell us that every single person in this world has something to contribute to Klal Yisrael that nobody else can. Sometimes you find a teacher in class sees a kid raise his hand and the kid asks a question that the teacher never thought of and the teacher doesn't know the answer. And it may be that the kid just stumped the teacher. Sometimes the teacher asks a question, maybe it's a question in the Mefarshim that's been on the books for 150 years. And one of the Talmidim, one of the students in Yeshiva, raises his hand and answers that question. And the answer is a good answer. And it says in our Sfarim that what is happening in such cases is that Hashem has predestined every single person with a job to do, with something to contribute to Torah in this world. And that something can only be contributed by that individual person and by nobody else. It's all over the works of the Chidah and other places. And if that person does not submit his contribution, his destined contribution, it will be lost forever. This is why they say that's a positive thing, even an obligation, to publish a person's Torah Chedushim, his Torah thoughts. Because those things that he thought of, it's possible that nobody else can think of. And Hashem does this on purpose. Doesn't it say, when Pinchas killed Zimri, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe Heichan Hoya, where was Moshe Rabbeinu? Why didn't he do it? And it says in Salam Imenu Halacha, that Min HaShemayim, God hid that halacha, that part of Torah from Moshe Rabbeinu, because that was Pinchas' destiny to do that, and only Pinchas was supposed to do that, not Moshe. And sometimes God hides Torah from all of us except for one of us, so that that person can contribute his piece to Torah. Yisro was one of those people. Maybe there was one question that Yisro had that nobody else could have thought of. Or maybe there was only one answer that Yisro could have given that nobody else could have. And Moshe Rabbeinu was telling Yisro, he says, Yisro, we need you. You will be the light of our eyes. Not every day. We have people greater than you. We have bigger scholars than you. But one day, the time is going to come where we're going to need you, and only you. And if you leave, we're going to be lost. And yes, Moshe could have said that to anybody in the world. To anybody in the world, you can tell them, we need you desperately. You have something to contribute that nobody else can. And without you, we are all lost. Those three words, we need you. Four words, we believe in you. If meant sincerely, if stated with conviction, are the most powerful things in the world. There's a story about Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha, where a parent of a retarded boy came to Reb Shlomo Zalman. And he told Reb Shlomo Zalman that they're going to relegate the boy to a certain institution. And Reb Shlomo Zalman said to the parents, did you speak to the boy about it? The parents said, what? Speak to the boy about it? He can't give us any input in this question. He can't help us out. What's the use of speaking to him? He doesn't know how to read or write. Reb Shlomo Zalman said that you're committing a tremendous crime. You can't make a lifetime commitment for this kid without consulting him first. Bring him to me. And the parents tell Reb Shlomo Zalman, Reb Shlomo Zalman, maybe you don't understand. This boy cannot think. This boy cannot make decisions for himself. You're going to speak to him, it's like talking to the wall. Reb Shlomo Zalman said, bring him to me. Oh, Reb Shlomo Zalman says, bring him, they brought him. I'm going to read to you precisely what Reb Shlomo Zalman told that boy. He said, first, what is your name? And the boy said, Akiva. Reb Shlomo Zalman said as follows. How do you do, Akiva? My name is Shlomo Zalman. I'm the Gadol HaDor, the greatest Torah authority of this generation, and everybody listens to me. You're going to enter a special school now, and I would like you to represent me and look after all the religious matters for me in your new home. You hear this? If Shlomo Zalman deputized this young boy and said, you are going to oversee all the religious boys in this institution and report back to me. And if anybody asks you what you're doing, you tell them, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach told me that I'm in charge of overseeing the religious boys in this institution. The boy's eyes were riveted to Rav Shlomo Zalman's face, and the awestruck parents sat with their mouths agape as Rav Shlomo Zalman continued, quote, I shall now give you smicha, which makes you a rabbi, and I want you to use this honor wisely. End quote. Shlomo Zalman gently stroked the child's cheek and saw that he was as eager as could be to fulfill his part of the agreement. Over the years, on numerous occasions, when this youngster was to spend a Shabbos at home, he refused to leave the institution, insisting that as the local rabbi, he had a responsibility to his constituents. After all, he had been charged with this responsibility by none other than the Gadol HaDor. This was not an act. Well, obviously, the boy did not learn Yoridea so that he can get smicha from Reb Shlomo Zalman. But when it says in that book that Reb Shlomo Zalman stroked his cheek, there was more than this boy's cheek that was stroked by Reb Shlomo Zalman. He told this boy, you are important. We need you. We believe in you. And this boy was willing to go into the institution because of those words. Satmar Rebbe Zecher Tzadik LeBracha once did the exact same thing to a runaway boy that came to him. He ran away from home, a boy who was in trouble. And he was living away from his parents. And the Satmar Rebbe asked him, he happened to have gone into the Rebbe, and Satmar Rebbe asked him, what do you do a whole day? Drugs his shoulders, what's he going to say? Satmar Rebbe tells him, do you learn? So he says, yes. And the Satmar Rebbe knew this was a bright boy. He said, are you writing down your Torah thoughts? So he says, yeah, I guess so. And the Satmar Rebbe says to him, this is an 18-year-old boy, says, I want you to write a sefer. And if you write a sefer, I'll give you a haskama. Everybody knows that the Satmar Rebbe Zatzal had a policy, he didn't write anybody haskamas. The greatest Gedolim came to him and he said, I'm sorry, I can't give you a haskama. And this is in writing, in place of a haskama, that's what they write. You know I don't give haskamas. And an 18-year-old boy, to give him chizuk, the Satmar Rebbe said, I'll give you a haskama. Now just imagine how far out the Rebbe stuck his neck out for this boy. He could have, chas v'sholem, made a big fool out of himself. 18-year-old kid comes with a sefer with the Satmar Rebbe's haskama. It could be humiliation, big bizyonis for him. But you know what? That boy didn't eat or sleep for 3 weeks, as much as humanly possible. The Satmar Rebbe is going to give me a haskama? And 3 weeks later, he came to the Satmar Rebbe with a manuscript, and the Satmar Rebbe gave him a haskama, and it was printed, and that changed that boy's particular boy's life. In none of these cases, the Satmar Rebbe or did Reb Shlomo Zalman say anything to the effect of, I accept you no matter what you are. Those words, no matter what you are poison. That's what we commonly understand to be acceptance. That's not acceptance. Acceptance is what Moshe Rabbeinu told Yisroi. You can be the light of our eyes. Acceptance is what the Satmar Rebbe told this boy, is what Reb Shlomo Zalman told that boy. There's a word from my father-in-law, Zichrono Livracha. My father-in-law was a rabbi for 45 years. His name was Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik. He said pshat in the pasuk that we say every day, Hashem, you stretch out your hands and you satisfy all living creatures. And then at the end, there's this word, this dangling word that seems not to belong. Ratzon. You masbi al chol chai, period. What is ratzon doing there, that word? A lot of interpretations. And my father-in-law, Zichrono Livracha, said that a person does not become satisfied with money. A person does not become satisfied with power. A person does not become satisfied with honor. The thing a person needs most in this world is for somebody to need him. For somebody to be wanted by somebody else. To be able to be needed, to contribute your chelik, your little part that nobody else can contribute. That's what makes people happy in this world. You may not have a penny. You may be unknown to most of the world, but if that... maybe that special person in your life really needs you, and you're full of life. If you have everything, nobody wants you, nobody cares about you, nobody needs you, then you have nothing. You stretch out your hands, and you satisfy every living creature by making him wanted. Pasuk is not referring to money. The pasuk is not referring to food. The pasuk is referring to that which makes people happy. And that is to be needed by somebody else. To be wanted by somebody else. This is what acceptance means. To be able to turn to a kid. You shouldn't even have to say it. Kid looks you in the eyes and he knows, I am needed, I am wanted. Not, I'm accepted even though I'm a fool. That I'm a pain in the neck, but my parents are such tzaddikim, they won't throw me out of the house. That's not acceptance. That's not the tolerance we're talking about. We're talking about no matter what. In the Satmar Rebbe's case, in Reb Shlomo Zalman's case, in Moshe Rabbeinu's case of Yisroi, there is always something special about every single human being. Everybody can contribute. Let me ask you this. Until now, we've been talking Divrei Torah. We're here in a doctor's house, in Dr. Rubin's house. Let's talk medical advice. Let's talk medicine here, biology. Every instinct that a person has is a biological necessity. We feel pain, and there's a reason for that. Because if our bodies wouldn't feel pain, we could sit down on a stove and not know that we're burning up until, Rahman al-Islam, we die. Anger is a biological necessity. It serves a function. It's fight or flight. Fear serves a function. Get out of the danger zone. All these are to protect us. This instinct that a person has, that he has to be part of something, that he has to be wanted and needed, tell me, what biological function does that serve? What is the purpose? Any instinct that Hashem gave has a biological purpose to protect the organism. Every urge that we have has a purpose, a biological purpose. What is the purpose in the instinct that a person has to contribute something, to say a thought, to be needed? That urge that a person has that makes him satisfied more than anything else, what's the point? Answer is in the Rashi. Anything that we don't know, you will be ma'areinenu. Because the way Hashem made the world, I don't know what a secular doctor would answer for this, but we know that the way Hashem made the world, Ein echod yocher lachadish mashachaveiroi mezumin lachadish. Every single person has his individual contribution to make. And that's part of kiyum ha'olam, that's part of the survival of the world. We need every single person. And in order to protect the contribution of each individual, which is so necessary for the societal survival, Hashem has given us an instinct that we need to contribute. We need our contribution to be wanted, to be accepted, to be requested. And if not, it hurts. The reason why children go off the derech more than any other reason, there are many reasons, many, many. The one that exists more than any other one is they feel rejection from those segments of Klal Yisrael to which they looked for acceptance. If a child feels rejected by the Torah world, maybe he was thrown out of yeshiva a half a dozen times. Maybe his parents are constantly putting him down. Maybe they're constantly criticizing him. Whatever the case is. Now, I'm not saying criticism is a bad thing. I'm not saying throwing a boy out of yeshiva is sometimes not the right thing to do. But if, by doing so, the child feels rejected, he will gravitate towards those places where he feels accepted. And nowadays, the way our world is set up, there are places where everybody in the world can feel accepted, and you don't want your children there. Chaim Shmulevitz, in the biography of Chaim Shmulevitz, it says that the issue, Bein Odom L'Chaveroi, that he spoke about more often than any other, is the humiliation of rejection. That the worst pain a person can feel is to be not wanted by those people who he admires. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says, this is the tragedy and the pain of the Aguna. It's not so much that now she has to live alone and never ever be able to have a life partner again, although that hurts tremendously. It's not the fact that she has to do everything, bring up her children alone, although that's tremendously difficult. The pain of the Aguna, said Reb Chaim, is the total rejection, by that person who she chose to be her life partner. And that is devastating more than anything else. If we want to know what the biggest antithesis to Torah is in this world, just the opposite of Kedusha, we know it's Amalek. Kadosh Baruch, whose name it says cannot be complete until Amalek is eliminated from the earth. How was Amalek created? This monster, this terrible scourge in the timeline of the history of Klal Yisrael. Chaim Shmulevitz points out that it was caused through the humiliation and the pain of rejection. As I'll say, that the mother of Amalek, a woman by the name of Timna, approached the Ovois, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yankov. She wanted them to convert her. She wanted to become a Jew. She really wanted sincerely to become a Jew. She said, she was a queen in her own country. And she said, better I should be a shifcha, better I should be a maid for the Jews than to be a queen of my nation. For reasons that, with the benefit of hindsight, we now consider obvious, Avram Avinu, the Ovis, rejected her. They chose not to convert her because of something they saw in her. But the Chazal say that because of this rejection, she decided to become the Pilegesh of Eliphaz, Esav's son. If you won't take me, Esav's family will take me. And through that union came Amalek. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz that this shows us the results, this shows us the fruits of rejection. It's important to know how to say no. But if no is said in a way that the child, it's not even children, adults also, feel rejected, and they're going to go somewhere they feel accepted. You know, when I was a little kid, and I'm sure we were all little kids, and we were doing something that our parents didn't want us to do, and we would say to our parents, yeah, but everybody's doing it. Or at least, so-and-so, my best friend is doing it. You know what our parents would say? They'd say, well, if so-and-so jumped off the roof, would you jump off the roof also? Right? Parents were wrong. Because, you know what? The answer is, if everybody would jump off the roof, we would jump off the roof with them. Because we feel better being dead at the base of the building with everybody than being alone on the roof with nobody there. Kid would rather be dead with his friends than alive with nobody. So you say, would you jump off the roof? The real answer the kid has in his mind is, yes, I would. Everybody in this world can use chizik, can use acceptance. Acceptance in our context means that you believe in them, that you feel that they have something to contribute. Even adults. I want to tell you a secret that many people may not know. If you have a rabbi who you think is maybe a very successful rabbi, all the balabatim and shul love him, a big Talmud Chacham, speaks well, he learns well, shakes hands with all the people when they come in, remembers everybody's anniversaries. If you think that inside that person doesn't need chizuk, that he doesn't need stroking, you're making a very big mistake. If you think that the most successful businessman, the highest level politician, he can have the highest office in the country, he can have the best office in the corporation, in the corner room with windows on both sides. If you think that that high and mighty, successful person doesn't need stroking, you are so sadly mistaken. There's a story once about the Chabina Rav. Chabina Rav, Zecher Tzadik L'Bracha, was one of the great Galitziana Gedolim. One Shabbos afternoon, an 8-year-old boy decided that he's going to ask the Chabina Rav a shaila. So he goes to the Chabina Rav's house and knocks on the door, and there's no answer. The boy knocks harder, and there's no answer. So the boy goes, bang, 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 bang. And again, bang, 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 until an obviously just woken out of his sleep Chabina Rav comes to the door, says, yes. And the boy says, I have a shaila, and he told him whatever he told him. So Chabina Rav asks the boy, he says, Yingala, don't you know that Shabbos afternoon, Jews sometimes like to sleep? So the boy said, in all honesty and innocence, he said, yeah, but Chabina Rav? Chabina Rav sleeps? They say that since then, the Chabina Rav didn't sleep Shabbos afternoon. Didn't sleep Shabbos afternoon. Hey, Sanilin, Chabina Rav sleeps? Chabina Rav? You have no idea what kind of effect your words have on people. Even people with the toughest skin. They don't have a tough skin. People don't have tough skins. You know what they have? They have high thresholds of pain. That's what they have. A tough skin means it doesn't hurt. It really does. It really does. It may not crack because of the pain, but that's not a tough skin. That's a high threshold of pain. Most of the time, that's what people have. The invulnerable ones. The unmovable ones. The ones that don't care what people say. It's usually they do care. But they have the fortitude to continue no matter what. Shamshon Raphael Hirsch made an incredible observation. He asked about people's instincts. He said, why does humiliation hurt? If you're embarrassed, why does it hurt? Why is it painful? What nerve endings were touched the wrong way? What biological function was hampered? What happened to you? What damage did you sustain that you should feel pain in the face of humiliation? And you know what he says? Listen to this. Every human being is an organism and is endowed with a survival instinct. That's why we're afraid of heights. That's why the adrenaline surges in danger. We have a survival instinct. The next worst thing to being dead is to be not counted. The survival instinct in a person, he says, makes sure, its job is to make sure a person is not dead. A person does not dissolve. A person is not eliminated. That same survival instinct is assaulted when a person is still physically alive, but socially eliminated. If you are ignored, if you are humiliated, if you are not treated with the dignity that a human being deserves, then you are socially eliminated. You don't count. You're not dead. You're still here, but only physically. You are ignored socially and psychologically, and therefore it is your survival instinct that is in pain. Want to hear the sensitivity of our Gedolei Yisrael? We have Moshe Rabbeinu, the Satmar Rav, Reb Shlomo Zalman. Now we have Reb Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein made a tremendous observation. He said, you know what the difference is between Europe and America? In Europe, when they had the stagecoach waiting for somebody, Reb Moshe said, they used to say, hurry, the balagola is waiting. Meaning, hurry, the coachman is waiting. Here in America, when the car service is waiting for you, you say, hurry, the taxi is waiting. Not the taxi driver. Hurry, the taxi is waiting. The difference is, it used to be that it was the human being that counted. And here it's not. I just noticed since I was a little kid, I want you to know, in Time magazine, they do that a lot. They tend to depersonify people. If you have, let's say, an executive of Exxon, they'll call him Exxon's Ploini Almoini. So-and-so's the company is in possession of the person. Newsweek doesn't do that, incidentally. Time magazine does. They depersonify people and they make them into a part of the big corporation. And that's one of the problems we have in America. Baron Cutler. Do you know that Baron Cutler was makpid at when they drove him from Lakewood to New York, and they passed the toll booths on the Garden State Parkway in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the guy had now it's, 35 cents, maybe then it was a nickel, to put into the toll in the exact change lanes. Baron Cutler was makpid that they go to the person manning the booth. You know that guy with the six earrings and the headphones, that lonely teenager that needed a job for the summer? So he took it on the highway. And Baron Cutler was makpid to take the time to go give him the money. You know why? Because imagine if you're that teenager in the toll booth and you see the car on the Garden State Parkway coming towards you. And as it sees the sign, cash, receipts, tokens, it veers away to the exact change lane. How does that guy feel? He feels like he has been taken over by a machine. And that's not nice. And Abaron didn't want that. I've seen children who have done very self-destructive things, things that are against their own self-interest, things that they don't want to do. The motivation behind their inexplicable actions is that they are gravitating to those places where people believe in them. To the gangs, maybe. To the girlfriends, maybe. To the shiksa next door, maybe. No matter what you offer them, you can't bribe them, you can't punish them. This is the most powerful thing. I got to tell you a story. I was very proud of myself about a month ago. This is usually not my normal field, intermarriages, but I stopped an intermarriage about 4 or 5 weeks ago. A 17-year-old girl that was thrown out of her school, she was a senior in high school, because the school found out that she was dating a non-Jewish man. Now, it was one of these Kiruv schools where none of the children are religious at all. Girl's father happens not to be Jewish. They threw her out because everybody in the school knew for the past 2 or 3 years this girl was dating this non-Jew. The administration just found out a few weeks before graduation. And they felt so embarrassed they decided to jettison this girl. I spoke to the principal on her behalf. I said, look, if the intermarriage rate amongst non-religious nowadays is 60%, the interdating rate has to be a lot higher than that. And if you have a school with 100 non-religious girls, what are you going to expect? Right? Going to throw her out to school for non-religious girls for being non-religious? But there was no talking to him. No toy, he's throwing her out. So, next thing to do is to try to speak to her. We'll call her Rachel. Even that wasn't her name. I was sitting with her, she was on the other side of the table with me, and I told her like this. I say, Rachel, I'm a rabbi. I know all the things that you're supposed to say. Oh, by the way, one more part to the story that I left out. This girl was my student 3 years ago. She remembers me, we had a very good student-teacher relationship then. I told her, Rachel, I'm a rabbi. I know all the things that it says in the books that I'm supposed to say to get you to break up with this guy. I'm supposed to say that when you get into a fight over balancing the checkbook, when you're married, he's going to say, oh, you cheap Jew. Supposed to say what's going to be with your kids. Are they going to grow up with a Christmas tree? Right? You're giving up your children for your husband. So I know all the things you're supposed to say. But I know it's not going to work. I'm not going to tell you all of that. But I'm going to tell you one thing that it doesn't say to say in any of the books. But I really, really mean it. Say, Rachel, we don't want to lose you. You're too valuable to lose. We need you. That's all. This little girl, there was tears coming down from her face. Imagine, she 3.5 years in a school and then they throw her out because they find out about this girl with an 85 to 90 average. She was a wonderfully behaved girl. And now her parents are angry at her also because of this. Oh, you got yourself kicked out of school. You know, what are you? And here comes this rabbi out of the blue. And says, Rachel, we need you. We don't want to lose you. If I'm speaking for all of Klal Yisrael, which is the truth. Because we don't want to lose her. And a week and a half later, she calls me back and says she gave Jose an ultimatum. Either he converts, a frum conversion, or it's over. I always tell parents that I don't have a magic wand that to give anybody for them to tap on the head of a kid to make him better or to make him good. But in truth, that's not really true. The truth is there is a magic wand. It's not easy to acquire. And the magic wand is, if you really sincerely want, need, and believe in a kid, then you have him in the palm of your hand. And it doesn't matter if you're a friend, it doesn't matter if you're his Rebbe, it doesn't matter if you're his mother, it doesn't matter if you're his girlfriend. That person that believes in him, that holds him high up on a pedestal, sincerely, that person, and you don't have to be a faker because everybody can contribute, that person that discovers that diamond inside the person, as that person in the palm of his hand, that person that needs him, that person that wants him, has him wrapped around his finger. Either it's going to be us, parents, or it's going to be somebody else. It's going to be the gang leader. It's going to be the kids in the pool hall or the pizza shops or by the canal or in Grand Prix or whatever's the case down here. Discipline is wonderful. Saying no, saying yes. Parents think, it happens all the time, they come to me and they say, should I say no to this? Should I say yes to this? Should I put my foot down here? Should I put my foot down there? And these are all decent questions, but they're not the main questions. It really doesn't matter all that much. If parents are a little too restrictive, or a little too lenient, or a little too liberal, or a little too strict, it doesn't really destroy a kid. It doesn't really matter all that much. There's right decisions and wrong decisions, of course. But if you, the kid knows that you believe in him, that you know how great he really is inside of that, like Moshe Rabbeinu told Yisroel, that you're going to be Ma'arei Neinu and we don't know anything. We need you. The family needs you. The school needs you. Klal Yisrael needs you. I'm your mother, I'm your father, I know you better than anybody else. And I know what you can contribute. And I'm going to tell you now what you can contribute. He may not believe you're really sincere. And it doesn't matter, a little too strict, a little less strict. It's not going to make a difference. He's going to understand. But without that, it's not going to work. Then it makes absolutely no difference. You can make all the right moves and put your foot down in all the right times and be strict in all the right places. If the kid feels rejected, then it makes no difference whatsoever. If the kid feels that the, you know, I was sitting with a couple one day, parents of a boy, but Kanai and Hora very successful in their business, and the boy had an anger, a hostility, almost a hatred towards his father. They always get into fights and arguments. It seems that the kid felt that the father was treating him like he treats his workers in the business. Don't do what I like, you're fired. Kid felt that, you know, that's the father's attitude. I don't like what you do, you're fired. I'll replace you with somebody. You know, we don't need a relationship. I'm the boss over here. If you don't like it, goodbye. And the father's telling me that he possesses a real dislike for this boy. I asked him, I said, Mr. So-and-so, I want to ask you something. His wife was there. His wife's a social worker. He's a businessman. If your son was in danger, if he was, Chalila, drowning, would you risk your life to save him? And his wife looks at him, says to him, well, what's the answer? He looks at me, and he says, you know, I don't want to answer that question. I told him, I say, I want to ask you something. Can I ask you something personal? He says, anything, no problem. He says, I don't want to answer that question. You could be sure that the father never articulated this. He never even thought about it until I brought it up. But that kid knows the answer to that question. That kid sees it, and every time the father looks at him, and every time the father talks at him, and every time the father gets angry at him, there's a difference between getting angry at a kid and rejecting him, and getting angry at a kid and accepting him. Now that we've established that acceptance is the most important thing, rejection is the most terrible thing, we're going to discuss just a little. We're going to begin to try to figure out, step by step, how do we build ourselves up to the level where we could say that we really believe and accept in our children, and how to convey that message to them. First thing is, this is something that we can all go home and start doing tonight. In order for a kid to feel loved, accepted, he has to feel understood. He has to feel that you know who he is. He has to feel that you understand him. Because if you don't, then it's not he who you love, it's somebody else. You know, it was an old vote from Reb Nachman Breslev. I said this a few times already in other lectures. Reb Nachman Breslev was once asked by somebody, he says, how do you explain the fact there's so many misnagdim who are such big tzaddikim, talmidei chachamim, who don't like you, who have so much against you? How do you explain that? And Reb Nachman said, you know, the misnagdim, they have nothing against me. They have something against that person who they think I am. And he deserves it. But it's not me. Now, what he's saying is that you can't dislike somebody who you don't know, because your dislike, your negative feelings are not directed at him. They're directed at an imaginary person. That has nothing to do with it. By the same token, you can't love anybody that you don't really know, because that love is directed at an imaginary person. Children have a tendency to hide their behavior so that the parents don't know him anymore. Once that happens, then the kid is going to run around saying, my parents don't love me. Did you ever hear this? My parents don't love me. You don't love me. And the parents sit there screaming, of course we love him, and there's tears in their eyes. You know what this means? This means they don't love me. They love that person who they think I am. He's lucky. It has nothing to do with me. We must get to know our children. I know we have no time for our children. I know we're all very busy. I know that there's a tremendous generation gap that exists now. Even though the parents of today's teenagers are largely American, and largely grew up in the same streets that the children grew up in, speak the same language. But the generation gap that exists today is so much broader, so much wider, so much deeper than that which existed when I was a kid and our parents were Europeans. Nevertheless, we have to make sure that we know our children. And how do we do that? How we do that. Forget about discipline for now. That's discipline's a different issue. Forget about lecturing. We have to listen. This is the rule. Hands down, mouth closed, mind open. That's the way it works. Hands down, mouth closed, mind open. We have to listen. We have to be good listeners. We have to let them tell us things. See, we have this instinct, this parental instinct, that tells us that it's our responsibility that when our children tell us something we don't like, we have to automatically object and be moistened. You know what it's like? It's like driving 60 miles per hour. I know you may not be able to relate to this in Miami, but if you're driving 60 miles an hour and then you hit an ice patch on the road and the car starts skidding, the natural instinct is to slam on the brakes. I know, they taught me in driver's education, that if you do that, you're dead. You can't follow your instincts. You have to use your brains and see what's the best for you. And we have this parental instinct that tells us that when the kids tell us something that we don't like, to slam on the brakes right there and then. The brakes are sometimes the kid's head. But we have that instinct to say no. And this way we alleviate ourselves of any guilt and any responsibility for the kid's actions. Because this way, you can say, well, I tried, I did my best, I told him I don't approve, I told him he just doesn't listen. I want him to listen. You got to get him to trust you. You want him to trust you, you got to get him to feel that you love him, that you believe in him. And the only way for you to do that is to understand him. Now, the first thing, besides being a good listener, is that you have to go and investigate and see, go around and look around at your children's world. Your children's world is a lot different than you think it is. The music they may be listening to, the people that they're hanging around with, the conversations that they're having with their friends, are a lot different than you think they are. Trust me, they are a lot different than you think they are. The kids know this. And the more the kids know that they are involved in things that the parents have no knowledge of, the less they value the parents' opinions. Because listen, if you're a doctor and a patient comes to you and you don't know half of the diagnosis, then what value is your opinion? And if you're a businessman and somebody comes to you with a deal and you don't know half of the facts, then what value is your decision? And if you're a parent and you have no idea what this kid is doing, where he's going, what he's thinking in his head, who he's speaking to, what he's saying, then of what value is your advice? I have over here the photostat. One example, and I gotta tell you that strange things come up in the most unlikely places. You think you send your kid to yeshiva and he's safe. At least then he's safe. You pay a lot of tuition for them at least to keep him safe from bad influences. Have over here a sefer written by Rabbi Avigdor Miller. And he writes over here, things that parents ought to be aware of. Read you what it says on page 373. Now listen, because you're not going to hear this anywhere else. There are very few people that would have the courage to write this. Quote, know who are the teachers in the Torah schools of your children, talking about the secular studies teachers, and insist that they be decent, observant Jews. For very many pupils have been corrupted by the secular teachers in the Mesistos. End quote. And I know this to be true. I know this to be true. Where students, kids in yeshiva, have been tremendously adversely affected by their own teachers. You'd think that what's going on in a classroom is at least safe because it's under the auspices of a chashuv, a rosh yeshiva, or a menahel. It's not so. Sometimes it is, but it's not necessarily so. And it's up to the parents to figure out what's going on. You have kids that go out at night. I remember once I was a teacher in a girls' school. One of the girls, 17-year-old girl, she would sneak out in the middle of the night, 1 o'clock in the morning, borrow the family car. Family was oblivious to all this because they were sleeping. She'd come back 6 o'clock in the morning, put the keys in the right spot. Nobody would know the difference. I remember once I went to Rav Palm, Zolzang Gesunds, with a Shaila. I was driving down a street in my neighborhood, Rockaway Turnpike. And there was this Dunkin' Donuts that it was 1 o'clock in the morning, it was all lit up, and there's a lot of glass so you can see inside, and there was this 14-year-old girl, somebody from my neighborhood, with a boy. They were sitting there in Dunkin' Donuts. And I stopped the car and I go in and I just ask the girl, who knew me, not personally, but she knew me as a rabbi in the community, I say, does your mother know you're here? Parents are divorced. She says, shh, no, don't tell her, I have to get home before she wakes up. So I asked Rav Pam if I should tell the parents. So he told me, whatever, it depends. Depends on the parents, depends on the kid, depends on a lot of things. But the point is that, I'm not saying this is happening everywhere, but it can happen anywhere. It can happen anywhere. We'd be surprised. I'm a teacher. I give finals. I proctor. It's my job to make sure that the students don't cheat. You have no idea how technologically advanced these students are when it comes to cheating. They have math tests, calculus tests, they use calculators, they share calculators. You know calculators have memory? Do you know that? We're behind the times. Calculators have memory. And kids that share calculators and math tests are basically sharing each other's notes. So many things about our children that we are just out of touch. We just don't know. And we have to make it our business to know. Because once you make it our business to know, then we can convey the message that we really believe in them. Because if you don't know these things, then it's not them. I'm going to end off, I'll take some questions, but I'm going to end off this last thing that I said is in this past week's Parsha in the Sephorno. When the Asafsof comes to Moshe Rabbeinu, and they tell Moshe Rabbeinu that they want meat in the desert, Moshe Rabbeinu turns to Hashem and says, what did I do wrong? What am I the father of this nation? What do I have to take this for? The Sephorno over here explains the key to controlling your children. This is what it says. Inei, ha'av yuchal lahanhig es bonov, afal pi shehem chiluke hadeyas. A father can still control the child even though they disagree. If they agree, you don't need to control him. But a father, meaning a parent, can control the child even though the child disagrees with the parent. How? V'zeh, ki kulam choyshvim oisoi lo'oyhev, she'yishtadel b'chol koychoy lehetiv lohem. Because the child considers the father, that the father loves the child, and the father will do whatever it takes for the child's good. That it doesn't say you have to learn how to smack. It doesn't say that you can control him by proper methods of punishment or proper methods of control. This is the Sephorno. This is not a social worker. There it is. Parshas Bahaloitho. The way parents control children when they disagree is when the children understand that the parents love them. Parentheses. That means the children understand that you know them. The children understand that you really understand who they are. Close parentheses. And that the parents are interested in doing whatever they need to do for the sake of the child. Not that the parents are embarrassed and that they're acting on their own behalf. Not that the parents are annoyed with the child and they want the child to stop screaming so their head can calm down a little. Not because it's good for the parents. Because the parents want good for them. And that brings us back to the first thing we said. Acceptance. Believing in somebody. Difference between a good kid and a bad kid. A good kid has somebody to believe in him. And a bad kid has somebody also to believe in him, but it's the wrong type of person. Kids gravitate towards those places where they feel comfortable. And it's our job to make them feel comfortable, warm, wanted, needed, and believed in our homes. And I'm going to take any questions if there are any.